Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us the next edition of the VOA Learning English series, America's Presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
15 years ago, Glenn Spencer left his home in California for a reason, to help secure the border between the United States and Mexico. Spencer now lives on a ranch in Arizona, about 100 meters from the metal barrier that separates the two countries. His one-man effort against illegal immigration has put people crossing the Sonoran Desert at risk. Spencer says he has reported or captured thousands of people over the past 15 years. He believes most of them were transporting illegal drugs. However, most experts say that drugs are rarely brought across the border that way. Spencer uses drone aircraft launched from his farm in Cochise County. He developed the drone technology he uses.
The computer's looking at 5 miles of information, and then when something happens, the algorithm says, "Hey, there's people out there."
Spencer leads a group called the American Border Patrol. It is considered a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, an organization that reports on and fights discrimination. Spencer says he has spent $1 million of his own money to stop the illegal movement of people across the border. He believes it is the reason he was born.
I kept digging and digging and digging. The more I dug, the uglier it became.
Spencer says he wants to show what he calls the truth about illegal immigration. He believes that Mexicans are plotting to take control of the southwestern United States by becoming a voting majority. He says that when immigrants vote in U.S. elections, they are voting in Mexico's best interests. He believes they want to cancel the 1848 Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Under the treaty, Mexico gave the United States 1.3 million square kilometers of land. Spencer is almost 80 years old. He says he is saddened by changes to the local population. He says they show that white people will no longer be in the majority.
This is not natural. Most of this is because of illegal immigration and what they call anchor babies, and then family reunification. I think we have to put a stop to this, because if you get a power block of Hispanics, and they've said this themselves, they're going to be a swing vote.
Juanita Molina is the head of a rights group called the Border Action Network. She says there are many people along the border who share Spencer's beliefs.
You see this trend, and you can see this in this presidency, of a culture of scarcity, this feeling that the America that they once knew is slipping away and is being stolen.
Mo Goldman is an immigration lawyer. He says many people in Arizona reject the actions and beliefs of people like Spencer. He believes Spencer and those like him are wasting their time.
Their viewpoint is, hey, we're patriotic. We're going to seal up the border. We're going to catch these people. We're going to call the Border Patrol. You know, if that's what they want to do, fine. I think a lot of people in this community think that that is not the right thing to do, and they reject that mentality.
Spencer says many opponents of illegal immigration have stopped giving money to his group because they believe President Donald Trump will close the border. But Spencer says even if others stop supporting him, he will keep watching the border. He adds, America can't start over again. That won't happen again. If we lose that, that's it. We have got to keep it. We've got to hold it. We've got to defend it. And that's what I do. I'm Brian Lynn.
Late last year, the United Nations promised to strengthen its fight against the spread of the deadly cholera disease. UN peacekeeping troops unknowingly brought the disease to Haiti 7 years ago. But so far, the UN has raised just a small amount of the estimated $400 million it needs over the next 2 years to fight the disease. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres wrote that the voluntary funding received so far makes up only 2% of its goal. It has received around $8 million in funding. As of February 8th, Chile, France, India, Liechtenstein, and South Korea together had promised almost $2 million. Outside of that fund, Japan has promised $2.6 million, and Canada has committed about $6 million. Guterres asked all member states to notify him by March 6th of their plans to help finance the campaign. UN peacekeepers arriving from Nepal are believed to have caused Haiti's current cholera epidemic. The disease spread near a UN base in October of 2010. Since then, more than 788,000 cases of the infectious disease have been reported. At least 9,000 people have died. Last December, former Secretary General Ban Ki-moon apologized to Haiti's people on behalf of the United Nations for the loss of life and suffering caused by the country's cholera epidemic.
The UN has two goals for the funding: reducing cholera and aiding victims. Its aim is to decrease the number of yearly cases from the current 30,000 to fewer than 10,000 by the end of 2018. It also plans to help all Haitians have clean drinking water and toilets by 2030. Right now, about 25% of the population owns or lives near toilets, the UN's recent letter said. Vibrio cholerae bacteria spread through food and water polluted by an infected person's feces or waste, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says. The disease is most common in places with poor waste and health systems. The UN also plans to provide material assistance to aid Haitians most affected by the epidemic. Brian Concannon is the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. The nonprofit organization supports Haitian cholera victims and their relatives. He told VOA that at one point, half of the expected $400 million was promised to victims. That money would be used for either community projects, such as new hospitals and schools, or direct payment to the families. But since little money has been raised, Concannon said that some have warned the victims to lower their expectations. However, he said that the cholera victims have a right to compensation under international law and that the UN must obey this law.
Gabriel Timothée is General Director of Haiti's Ministry of Public Health. He said Haitians have not given up hope that the UN will meet its funding goal. Right now, Timothée said, the ministry is trying to reduce infections. It gave out 1 million vaccine doses in southern Haiti after the damaging hurricane last October. The UN's World Health Organization provided the vaccines, and the ministry is planning a national vaccination program. The ministry is also teaching the public good cleanliness practices and providing clean water. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Scientists think they have discovered a way to use a common bacteria to stop disease-carrying mosquitoes from reproducing. They say the discovery could make it possible to control the mosquito that spreads two viral diseases, Zika virus and dengue. The bacteria is called Wolbachia. It can infect up to 70% of the insect species on Earth. The bacteria has changed in different ways over time. Some insects need it to stay alive. Wolbachia can act as a parasite in other insects. It can even affect the ability of eggs to produce young. However, experts say it does not infect many disease-carrying mosquitoes. But researchers may have found a way to use the bacteria on mosquitoes that carry two viral diseases, Zika and dengue. Experts say a woman infected with Zika virus early in her pregnancy is at risk of giving birth to a baby with microcephaly. Microcephaly causes mental and physical disability, seizures, and sometimes death. Dengue can make people very sick. A person develops a condition like influenza. The disease can also turn deadly. John Beckman is an entomologist, someone who studies insects at Yale University in Connecticut.
It's kind of been the issue with the Wolbachia field is that all the insects that are really, really medically relevant don't have their own Wolbachia infections. So that's one reason why this is such an important discovery, is because that's been one thing that's limited the field, is people have always tried to make these fake or non-natural infections that can infect these mosquitoes. Now we don't have to do that. We can just put the genes in.
Aedes aegypti is the name of a mosquito that carries Zika and dengue. Researchers at Yale and Vanderbilt University in Tennessee are studying the Wolbachia bacteria. They reported finding two genes that might make the mosquitoes unable to have young. The researchers have performed successful experiments in fruit flies, and they believe they can do the same with mosquitoes. The scientists reported success with two ways to stop the spread of Zika and dengue. The first was to place many male mosquitoes carrying Wolbachia in an area. When these males mate with uninfected females, the bacteria kills life in any eggs the female is carrying. The other method involved leaving male and female mosquitoes infected with Wolbachia in a mosquito population. Over time, the Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes replaced the Zika and dengue-infected mosquitoes by making them sterile. Reports on the Wolbachia gene discovery were published in the journals Nature and Nature Microbiology. John Beckman says controlling the two diseases may one day be as simple as breeding Wolbachia-carrying mosquitoes, then releasing them into the wild.
The problem has always been figuring out systems that can work well in mosquitoes, and this seems like this is going to be one that's going to be great for that.
He adds that the discovery may also work with Anopheles gambiae, the mosquito that carries malaria. The World Health Organization says there are 214 million cases of malaria each year, and the disease kills over 400,000 people a year worldwide. Because the mosquitoes are genetically engineered, Beckman says he is concerned about legal barriers on the release of sterilized mosquitoes. He and other researchers are working to find money to pay for more experiments. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. James Madison was elected in 1808. He was a capable president who served two terms. But most Americans do not remember Madison for his presidency. They remember him for work he did earlier. After the Revolutionary War, in which the American colonists separated from Britain, Madison proposed that the new United States form a stronger national government. Madison's vision for a three-part government, with an executive, a legislature, and an independent Supreme Court, became the basis for the Constitution we still use today. Madison went on to persuade voters to accept the proposed Constitution. He explained how a system of checks and balances would prevent any one part of government from becoming too powerful. And when voters demanded more protection for individual liberties, Madison wrote the amendments that became the Bill of Rights. These actions earned Madison the name Father of the Constitution. Madison did not have the appearance of most politicians. He was a short man with a soft voice who had been sick often as a child. He grew up in a wealthy family in Virginia. He liked to read books and to study. He went to college at the school that later became Princeton University in New Jersey. When the Revolutionary War started, Madison's intelligence and knowledge, as well as family money, helped him participate in debates about independence. Madison also held positions in the new American government he helped create, including as Secretary of State under President Thomas Jefferson. Madison did not have much of a personal life. Many people were surprised when he married a young widow named Dolly Payne Todd. She was 26. He was 43. The couple did not have children, but they raised Mrs. Madison's surviving son together. Stories suggest the two were very happy, although they had different personalities. Dolly Madison was energetic, warm, and social. She loved to throw parties, and her guests loved to attend them. Historian Catherine Algor notes, Dolly Madison often dressed dramatically, including wearing turbans covered with peacock feathers. Her weekly gatherings at the president's house were so crowded that they became known as squeezes. As First Lady, Dolly Madison did not follow her husband's idea of a strict separation of powers. She invited officials from all parts of the government to her parties, as well as people from opposing political groups. Algor says, Dolly Madison succeeded in making the president's house a symbol of unity and glamour. She remains one of the best known and most loved first ladies in U.S. history. But his wife's popularity could not prevent Madison from facing a difficult presidency. During his first term, the U.S. faced increasingly tense relations with Britain. Madison accused the British of interfering with international trade and seizing American sailors. At the same time, European American settlers blamed the British for helping native tribes fight against them. But the settlers had violated treaties between the U.S. government and the Native Americans. In 1811, Native warriors attacked U.S. soldiers at the Battle of Tippecanoe in today's state of Indiana. A U.S. general named William Henry Harrison led his troops to fight back. The result was not clear, but Harrison declared victory. The following year, Madison proposed war against Britain. Congress approved. the War of 1812 began. For most of the war, American forces failed. But in 1813, they had two notable victories in Canada. They captured and burned the city of York in Toronto. And General Harrison had another major fight with Native warriors at the Battle of the Thames. The Native Americans were defeated. The leader of the tribal alliance, Tecumseh, died from the wounds he received there. That loss ended, for the most part, the efforts of Eastern Native American tribes to push back white settlers. In 1814, the war turned again. British soldiers took the U.S. capital of Washington, D.C. Madison had already left the president's house to meet with generals in the field. Dolly Madison remained. But when she learned the British were approaching quickly, she acted. She famously ordered her servants, as well as a 15-year-old house slave named Paul Jennings, to take down a painting of George Washington. The servants, slaves, first lady, and painting all escaped to safety. Commanders of the British force took a group of men to the Capitol building and set it on fire. Then they went to the president's house. They found the table set for dinner. The British commanders stopped to toast the president before they burned his home. By the time Washington, D.C. burned, American and British officials were already in peace talks. But in the U.S., one more major battle was being fought. A militia general named Andrew Jackson led a ragtag army against a British attack in New Orleans, Louisiana. The Americans' rain of bullets and shells was so deadly that only one British soldier reached the top of the American defenses. When the British finally withdrew, they left behind more than 2,000 dead and wounded. 500 other British soldiers had been captured. 13 Americans were killed. The Battle of New Orleans was considered a great victory for the U.S. However, it was not necessary. The war had ended by treaty 2 weeks earlier. The War of 1812 almost bankrupted the U.S. government and cost the lives of tens of thousands of soldiers. It was devastating for many Native Americans. It did provide a chance for several thousand slaves to escape to freedom by serving in the British military. But it did nothing to improve the lives of most of 1 million enslaved people in the U.S. at the time. Despite all this, the war united most of the country. Albert Gallatin, Madison's Treasury Secretary, said people felt more American after the war. They acted more like a nation, he said. The song that would become the country's national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, was written during the War of 1812. Madison benefited from most people's belief that the war was a success. The end of his second term began what historians call the era of good feelings. Madison left the presidency more popular than when he had started it. After he retired, Madison lived on his Virginia estate for nearly another 20 years. He died in his bed at age 85. A niece was in the room. She says that a strange look passed her uncle's face. She asked him what was wrong. Madison's last words were, "Nothing more than a change of mind, my dear. I always talk better lying down." I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.